Women in state capitals across the country are sharing stories of sexual harassment as the Me Too hashtag campaign continues. In Springfield, almost 200 women in politics have signed an open letter sharing their stories, including Katie McFadden.
The power dynamics are really at the core of the issues here, right? It's unclear who to go to. There's no HR department of the Capitol.
We'll hear from her and the co-founders of the hashtag Illinois Say No More, along with state senators Toy Hutchinson and Jason Barrickman. Plus, the moments after a heart attack are critical for survival.
So the chance of survival without CPR being initiated pretty quickly or effective deployment of defibrillation, I mean, the chances really start to diminish quite readily.
A new app that just launched in Central Illinois this week hopes to prevent that with help from citizen CPR rescuers. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Yesterday, the culture of sexual harassment in Springfield very quickly became the central story as lawmakers gathered during a veto session. It started with Katie McFadden, who runs Sierra Club Illinois' political program, sharing her thoughts in a story to a national publication, The Hill. Here's what she said, quote, "I've had hands up my skirt, I've had my hair pulled, and there's just nothing you can really do." Well, now a powerful group of women want to change that. Almost 200 women, including state senators, representatives, lobbyists, and staffers, have signed on to an open letter that share upsetting stories of what's happened to them. It starts, "Every industry has its own version of the casting couch. Illinois politics is no exception. Ask any woman who has lobbied the halls of the Capitol, staffed council chambers, or slogged through brutal hours on the campaign trail. Misogyny is alive and well in this industry." There's been a flurry of reaction to that. Yesterday, lawmakers from both parties moved quickly to support State Representative Sarah Feigenholt's call for a resolution to address the issue. Gubernatorial candidate and Senator Daniel Biss and his running mate, Letitia Wallace, have also introduced legislation that would require most of all Capitol staff and lobbyists to undergo sexual harassment training. Last week, Republican House Leader Jim Durkin's chief of staff had already sent a memo to workers reminding them of anti-harassment policies. Today, we're going to be speaking with state lawmakers from both parties about this issue. But first, we wanted to start with two of the women who helped begin this discussion. Katie McFadden is deputy director of Sierra Club Illinois, and she's on the line from Washington. Hi, Katie. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
In studio here with me in Chicago is Ellie Barmusel, one of the many women behind that letter, which also has its own hashtag as well, Illinois Say No More. Hi, Ellie. Good morning. Thanks for being here as well.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Katie, can I start with you and that Hill story that came out, I believe, on Monday when the reporter, when you had that interaction with the reporter to ask you about your experiences? I wonder what your first thought was.
Sure. I mean, I have to admit, I had to think about if I was willing to speak out and if I was willing to speak out on the record. And so that was, you know, a serious thing that I had to take a moment or two and really grapple with, because the reality here is that, you know, women who are speaking out are worried what this is going to mean, not only for our careers, but also for, you know, our peers and colleagues and, you know, that work in this industry. But ultimately, you know, I spoke out because I and countless women in the halls of power, not just in Springfield, but, you know, the halls of power across the state, across this country, have been faced with decades of harassment because of our gender. What's happened to me, what's happened to my career is, I think, in no ways unique. But it's 2017. It's time for us to speak out, make sure that women are on an equal playing field. And I felt in a position to share my story as a way to highlight these instances that happen to so many that are not able to speak out. You know, there's so few women in these spaces. There's so few women of color. There's so few queer women in these rooms. It makes it even harder for them to speak out.
Ellie, around the time that Katie's story was coming out, you had been part of a group of women that all last week had been having conversations about this as well. How did that start? And that happened on a private Facebook group, am I correct?
Yeah, so The timing was rather serendipitous with Katie's very brave piece in The Hill. And about a week ago, a number of us, as the Harvey Weinstein allegations broke, were having private conversations in a text group about how pervasive this misogynistic culture is across industries, not just in Hollywood, and how we had all experienced some version of this behavior in our careers in state, local, and national politics. And we decided that with all of these stories amongst ourselves, we should certainly put something out there to let other women know that they aren't alone, and to send a broader message that there needs to be a shift in this culture. And we thought that the best way to do that would be to pen a letter that demonstrated some of the lived experience of the women who had been in the conversation and put it out there for the world to see.
As we think about that, Ellie, as I look at this letter, I mean, there's so many stories that are really, they're really painful stories to read. They start with, you're just sort of saying what this looks like, right? It looks like a male legislator, a chamber leader, asking a female staffer out to dinner under the guise of offering mentorship, then proceeding to explain his, quote, open marriage to her and ask if she's single. And then it kind of goes on and on with all of these different stories. As Katie said, Katie, I mean, there is a culture of, there are real consequences to women sharing these stories. Ellie, how did you navigate that? Because it's a really tough thing.
I think that there is power in numbers. And there was something really poignant about each time a woman in our little group shared a story, there was a me too after they spoke their truth. And it became really apparent that there are so many women who have these stories, who say, me too, who aren't in a position to be able to share their stories because they have very real fear about the repercussions of sharing these stories. And we realized, as painful as it was to even say the words out loud, that it would be that much more painful to know that we had a moment in time where we could use our voice to hopefully chart a new direction for the culture of politics, not just here in Illinois, but nationally. And to not use our voice felt more painful. So some of the women who contributed their stories have been more public about their journey. Others have chosen to take a back seat. But we really believe that the collective of our voices and our stories and the rallying cry of saying, Illinois, say no more to this, will hopefully create a change so that the next generation of people who choose to lend their talents to public service will inherit a better culture than the one we did.
That's Ellie Barmusel. We're speaking with her as well as Katie McFadden, Deputy Director of Sierra Club Illinois. You're, as always, welcome to join our conversation. You can tweet to us using our handle. It's 21STShow. Katie, to Ellie's point about repercussions, you said there's really the problem in when you're talking about politics isn't necessarily human resources to go to, although I must say that doesn't by any means necessarily guarantee action or change, but it does at least provide a system of checks. Do you think, Katie, that's one of the biggest problems, that there isn't necessarily a system of checks on powerful people who are abusing their position?
I do think that's an important thing that needs to be addressed. I think the efforts that we've seen so quickly just in the past 48 hours around mandatory training is absolutely a great first step and a step in the right direction. But really, this is a pervasive culture, and it's a culture that also is not just about sexual harassment, right? So this is not about just women as victims. It's about truly a fundamental breakdown in the legislative and democratic processes, right? So if harassment and sexism is preventing women, half of our population, from, you know, really contributing in these policymaking arenas, if it's deterring, you know, really smart, really competent women that have a lot to add to the many problems that our state is facing right now, and those women don't feel like they're able to contribute or they're turned away from, you know, being a part of these legislative processes, I mean, that's a real problem for our state. I personally, you know, I've devoted my life to using the democratic and legislative process to make this state stronger, to make our planet cleaner, to make our communities healthier. And at the end of the day, you know, I chose to speak up because this issue is not just harmful to women, but it's harming the democratic processes to be able to make policies that work for Illinois.
And Katie, as you think about that, I mean, we've been hearing these Me Too stories across all industries, and I would be remiss at this point. Obviously, we're hearing about this in Hollywood, in Silicon Valley, every woman. I have my own stories of this happening in journalism. But what I want to ask you is, you know, we hold political officials accountable. They can lose their jobs. And yet I think this culture persists. And I wanted to just ask you why you think that is.
I think this culture persists because we let it. I think that right now, like I said, the training is a great first step, but I think, you know, to ensure that this is not just lip service, I think that we need to do some soul searching, right? Men need to ask themselves, what are they doing to disrupt this behavior? Are they speaking up when they see it? Are they having the backs of women when they see this happening? This is a deeper problem that is deeply baked into these spaces, not just Springfield, but, you know, as you say, in a lot of places. I would say, you know, as this conversation has started over the past couple of days, I've been overwhelmed with the amount of positive feedback that I've been getting. I've had male legislators call me, say, you know, I'm sorry that I didn't do more. I always knew this was a thing, and I am gonna disrupt this behavior when I see it. I always was afraid to speak up before and didn't want to rock the boat, but that's not leadership. And these men are our leaders. You know, we voted them into these positions, and you know, I'm encouraged to hear so many that are willing to address this now, that are willing to step up and really lead on this issue as well.
That's Katie McFadden with Sierra Club Illinois. Ellie Barmusel is here with us as well. And I want to welcome one more person to this conversation. Senator Toy Hutchinson is a Democrat. She represents Illinois' 40th district in Chicago's south suburbs, all the way down to Kankakee. She's also one of the women who has signed on to this open letter. Senator Hutchinson, welcome back to the 21st. Thank you for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
As you're hearing these stories being shared, I want to just ask you, what was sort of your also initial impulse to join this group and to sign on to this open letter?
Well, I think one of the things that we probably should make sure we talk about is that there was a lot of, in the initial conversations, nervousness about this. Like, at every level, people who have experienced this, have stories to share about this, we were all like, okay, what do we really want to do? There was some talk about whether or not elected officials would sign on to the letter, if we would just respond to the letter. But the bigger point in that is that every single woman we know has a Me Too story. So that it wasn't something that I could see and read and not sign on to. So it's been a fascinating last couple of days, really watching how people are processing this and what people are saying as a result of this agitation that's happened in the Capitol now.
What are people saying to you, Senator?
Well, you know, there's a lot of there has been a lot of positive feedback. The fact that it's moving quickly, the speaker announced that he's going to file some legislation. We've had a lot of talks in our own caucuses about it and about, you know, making sure that training is available to everybody. I think the biggest thing is keeping the point that we have to create a space for people to talk about it, because in your earlier segment when you talked about people are asking what the next steps are. What happens as a result of this? Are people going to be naming names? What does this look like now in a very hyper-partisan election cycle? And that's not what this is about. What it's about is that it happens in silence. And I think the reason we wanted to say we're going to move past the Me Too to no more is for that reason exactly. It happens in silence, and people are tired of being silenced about it. So the conversations have been, they've run the gamut. You know, we've had people come in and go ask for permission to hug. And, you know, sometimes I smile at that because I say, there's a way to be professional and friendly and collegiate with colleagues without crossing a line.
Right, without being creepy.
Right. And you would hope that people would know what that is. There's also been some of the feedback about, well, what happens when women try to use, you know, their sexuality to get what they want? And we're really trying to stay focused on an imbalance of power. When there is an imbalance of power, that's when you get into, you know, actionable things, where it's you're really talking about crossing not only a social line and a moral line, but a legal line. And what ends up happening in arenas like this is that it's just you smile, you laugh it off, and you realize you do what you need to do to keep working. Nobody wants to be known as the one who's too sensitive or the one who, you know, can't be alone with a man because they're going to be charged with, you know, sexual harassment. That
right.
overreach
right.
is what we need to talk about, because relationships between men and women in the workplace are still fraught with what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. So hopefully this dialogue moves the ball.
Right. I mean, we've all done that. I think every woman, I think, who's listening will probably acknowledge that. I've done that, Senator. I'm sure you've said you've done that. Kind of the woman who's just laughed it off or just thought, I need to get through this interview. For
right.
you, I need to get this bill passed. Ellie,
right.
as we just have about a minute before we go to break, but I just wanted to just hear some final thoughts from you about this, how you want to see this moving forward.
Yeah, I've always believed that sunlight is the best sanitizer. So when we talk about why people haven't been held accountable for these actions in the past, it's because we haven't been able to shed light on them. And my greatest hope is that we create the container for fruitful, productive dialogues that let us talk about the systemic reasons why this culture exists and start talking what are the steps that we can take proactively to shift this culture, create more equity, more justice in the imbalance of power that currently exists, so that 5-10 years from now, when people look at the Capitol, Chicago City Hall, or any unit of government where people legislate and lobby, that they see that there's equity for men and women.
That's Ellie Barmusel. I want to thank her, as long as Katie McFadden, for joining us. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with a bipartisan group of senators, Senator Hutchinson, Senator Berkman, Senator Althoffer, all going to be joining us. Stay tuned as we continue to talk about this issue of sexual harassment in the Capitol. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible in part by Krannert Art Museum at the University of Illinois, presenting Coveting Nature, Art, Collecting, and Natural History in Early Modern Europe, an exhibition of botanical artwork from U of I collections. More information is available at kam.illinois.edu.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about the issue of sexual harassment in our state capitol. Yesterday, lawmakers from both parties moved quickly to support calls for resolutions to address the issue, whether we're talking about sexual harassment training, legislation that would require that for most capitol staff and lobbyists. As we said, this is happening in both parties. Both Speaker of the House Madigan has put out statements about this. Republican House Leader Jim Durkin's chief of staff last week had already sent a memo to workers reminding them of anti-harassment policies. We've got a couple senators on the line here to talk about this issue. I want to first, though, go to Steve Brown, who is the press secretary for House Speaker Madigan. Hey, Steve, welcome to the 21st. Steve? Steve, are you there? All right. It looks like we're having a problem getting a hold of Steve.
Well, Steve's on the line.
There he is. Hey, Steve. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
So we know that House Speaker Madigan put out a formal statement about this yesterday, and there was a Democratic caucus meeting. What's going on with the idea of legislation? Is that going to be filed soon in terms of this issue of sexual harassment?
One of the things that occurred in the caucus was, among other things, was a pledge by the Speaker to have our staff meet with members of the legislature to help develop this legislation. So the part of that work is being done. Those meetings have not occurred. I suspect they will occur yet this week, and I suspect there will be finalized legislation, and probably, I hate to do predictions because I'm not always right, but probably before the end of the veto session, which would be we come back a week after next, this legislation will likely be acted on.
And what will be in the legislation?
I think it'll be several areas. It'll be a stepped-up effort at training for legislators, staff in the area of sexual harassment, and the whole process will be broadened to include those who registered a lobby in Springfield, so that they would be required to get training. They would require to file what you would call a sexual harassment policy as part of the documents that they file in lobbyist registration, and then there would be a process for those who felt they were being harassed by a lobbyist to report that. That would be in addition to what many believe is an existing avenue of going through the Human Rights Commission.
Okay.
But right. in addition to the policies that are in place now for elected officials and staff in the legislature.
From the speaker's perspective, is what's in place now sufficient?
Well, we're going to take these additional steps.
Okay.
Because there has been, you know, this public discussion that's ensued, I think, that was probably largely sparked by the events relating to Harvey Weinstein that has caused additional discussion. So I'm not going to be, or the speaker's not going to be in a position to make an assessment about whether this is adequate or not. Let's take some additional steps. Let's broaden who is required to take training, to report, et cetera, to everybody that's involved.
That's Steve Brown, Press Secretary for House Speaker Michael Madigan. Thanks for being with us, Steve. We've also been speaking with Senator Toy Hutchinson. As I'd like to welcome, not just as we've been talking to Senator Hutchinson, her Republican colleagues, Senator Jason Berrickman, who represents the Bloomington area, Senator Pamela Althoff, whose 32nd district includes McHenry County and stretches up to the Wisconsin border. Senators, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you.
Senator Berrickman, can I start with you? As you've been hearing these stories, and I assume you've read the letter, did any of this surprise you?
Well, you know, I think this is one of those issues where this letter, you know, this kind of this public and open letter came out, and it caused a conversation among a number of us. Honestly, you know, it caused a conversation among my wife and I. And I, you know, I've got a young family. My wife is young, and I said, you know, what's your reaction to what's going on? My wife is part of the social media hashtag MeToo campaign, where, you know, that has been going on, that kind of resulted from the Harvey Weinstein, you know, disaster. And I think more than, you know, I think the legislature is going down a path where we're going to set in place, you know, new laws, new procedures that hopefully are going to be helpful. But there's an awareness component to this that I think is also necessary and is a part of all of us having these discussions. For us, at a personal level, I have found that the experiences of my wife, you know, are quite different than mine as a, you know, as a 42-year-old male who works in a political environment. My wife's familiar, you know, she accompanies me at a lot of things. She has just different perceptions and different vantage point, you may say. And so I think it's important that as we do this, we heighten the awareness of all of us to the circumstances that individuals are placed in. I think we're hearing from a number of women who, for one reason or another, are now coming forward. And I think part of the purpose that you know, as we look internally, part of the purpose needs to be that we raise awareness and we create a culture that both discourages this type of behavior, gives avenues for those who are, you know, impacted by it to seek relief and a remedy, but also seek a culture that where, you know, even if the processes aren't all there, there are people and an environment that you know, that strongly discourages these wrong types of behavior within our working environment.
Senator Althoff, you've been listening into the conversation. I wanted to ask you about your experience and also about how much you think this is an issue of representation when we look at just sheer numbers of how many women are represented in the legislature, not just obviously here in Illinois, but even nationally. When we look at the numbers, it's about 25%, I believe, nationally of state lawmakers are female versus male.
Well, I think it's a wide variety of reasons, but obviously the culture that exists or that has been hidden for a long time and not really talked about needs to be brought into the light of day. We need, as leaders in our own right, within our own districts, leaders here within the Capitol, within the governmental process, we need to use this as an opportunity to broaden awareness, require training, require education, and basically establish a new environment, a new culture, if you will, where young women in particular, but all women, feel that that type of behavior that we're looking at, that sexual predatory behavior, is just absolutely unacceptable, whether it's done in a kidding fashion or whether it actually crosses the line. There needs to be an awareness that we have an obligation to create a safe environment for all.
Do you feel that that environment exists right now, Senator Althaus? Do you think there is a pervasive problem, a cultural problem within the Capitol?
Well, I don't know if there's a pervasive problem, but obviously the conversation has been started, and we need to ensure that today we take action and we don't allow it just to be a conversation, that there are steps and that there are activities and that there is action that will occur because of this conversation. And it's not something that you just stand around a water cooler and talk about, but that you use the opportunity to create some type of follow-up action. And I think that what we hear going, the required training, the fact that we are also having lobbyists, any entity that is involved in governmental work, that we are all responsible for ensuring that we have a safe environment for all.
Senator Hutchinson, what about you? Do you see this? Do you feel like this is a pervasive problem?
So in the span of 24 hours, and I thank you for mentioning the number of women that are elected across the country. I'm the president-elect of the National Conference of State Legislatures, and those are statistics that were sent out by NCSL. It's about 24.6%. I don't know how you get 0.6% of a legislator, but
right. That's why I said about
25% of women that are holding state legislative positions across the country. And yes, I do think it's pervasive. And over the last 48 hours of this Facebook group going live, so many people have come on and shared their stories, and the stories are numbering in the hundreds. Now, some people will say, you know, back when I was in Springfield, back when I was, you know, you don't know whether these are current things or past things, but the point is, it's been going on for decades and decades and decades. So I want to really make clear that when the group of legislators and lobbyists and consultants did the letter in California, one of the things that they pointed out was that this is something that happens across all industries. That's why in our Facebook feeds, almost every woman you know is saying hashtag me too. It happens across all industries, and we can't continue to behave that it wouldn't happen in the arena of politics. Both Democrats and Republicans, doesn't matter what you look like, how you were dressed, what your socioeconomic background is, how educated you are, that doesn't matter. Almost every single woman we know. And one of the things in terms of talking about it is that I do believe that for a long time, the women amongst us have been talking about it. We talk about it to each other all the time. We give each other warnings. When young women start working in the Capitol, there's ways where you create your own boundaries, and you get warned about who not to come around, and warned
who
about
not to be alone with.
Who
right.
not to be alone with. You get warned about how to do the reception circuit. You get warned about all those things. And I think the reason why I was so adamant about signing on is that at some point, I don't want to have to give those warnings. We shouldn't have to warn young women like the onus is only on us. So these conversations and the dialogue that it's stepped up in is also happening amongst men when we're not there. And we need those guys to be like, when I see it, I'm going to say something. We need people. We need all our allies. We need everybody to say, this is unacceptable.
Yeah.
And today, you know, in 2017, the young women I come across, they're not trying to hear a whole lot of warnings about what they can and can't do. This is a very empowered group of young women. And I don't want to create, you know, we want 5 years and 10 years from now where the standard thing isn't that warning, but the standard thing is you are good at what you do, you are brilliant, you are talented, and we want your service in all areas of government. We don't want a brain drain. We don't, because it affects you subtly every single day, how you do your job, what you decide to wear, where, what receptions and things you go to. The stories that have come out have been literally heartbreaking. And but they're happening now because it's a national conversation. And if we couldn't, it needed to happen now, because if we couldn't talk about it in the space of all of this, when could we?
Right. So yeah, thanks
that
for
the
that,
power
Senator.
Of the timing, I think.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that, Senator Hutchinson. Senator Berrickman, not to put all the pressure on you because you're the only male in this conversation, but I do want to ask, you know, what, first of all, sort of what you feel like you need to say to your male colleagues. Like, are there conversations among male colleagues? Were there conversations about this prior to the past 48 hours ago? Maybe I should start with that. And do you think that will change if there haven't been?
Yeah, I can't say that there were, you know, significant conversations about this before the more recent events. Why I think there's been such a call to action now. I think, you know, it's hard to know all of what's going to come from this. But the notion that there simply needs to be bright lines, and that we as males in this conversation, right, we need to take part to make sure that we're aware of the circumstances that often our women are placed in, that we need to be supportive of our women who may be put in those circumstances, or worse, have someone, you know, do something against a woman. And we need to make sure that we're doing our part not to turn a cold shoulder, a blind eye towards these circumstances, and that we're doing our part to proactively stop it. And I do think that's a I think that's a conversation that's ongoing, and one that's helpful and productive to hopefully changing. Ultimately, I think the big issue here is ultimately changing the culture of the workplace. And Senator Hutchinson made a reference to this. This isn't limited to politics, but it is. We live in a political world, and the thing.
No, but right, and it is about power, right, Senator Berrickman? And I think that's something that's particularly always an issue within politics, of a power dynamic. So I guess I'm curious, right, about, you know, unfortunately, I'm sorry, we just have a minute or two left, but just your thoughts on where we move forward from here, how we can be more empowering for both men and women on this issue.
Well, I think that, you know, women who have advanced their political career, us seeing more women, you know, you talked about the statistics and maybe we have a ways to go, but having more women in elected office, having more women in senior staff roles, all are important components to addressing this issue that is, you know, one of culture. And so I think that's another byproduct or product of this, is seeing and advancing women to some of those positions that have long been held by men, you know, that have maybe reinforced these, you know, this culture unfairly so. And mm-hmm. So I think we're going to see some
right.
of those changes, and it'll be helpful.
Thanks for that. Senator Althaus, with just a minute left, let me just ask you about, I was frankly surprised at how quickly the bipartisan group of legislators moved on this issue. What would you like to see happen next?
That the conversation continue and that we do put into place action steps. I think this is an extraordinarily important time. People are paying attention. There's not a better opportunity in which to ensure that the conversation stays in the Capitol and then moves outside the Capitol to all of those entities or all of those organizations and business ideas that we just discussed, you know, all the industry. We said it's not just government. It's in all areas of business, in all areas of the world. We need to ensure the conversation end up in action.
Senator Pamela Althoff is a Republican representing McHenry County. Senator Jason Berkman is also a Republican up from Bloomington. Senator Toy Hutchinson, a Democrat from Chicago South Suburbs. All senators, thank you for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Listening to the 21st, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in. During a medical emergency, lives can be saved and lost in just minutes. Whether it's a heart stopping or a blockage that stopped breathing, it only takes 4 to 6 minutes until a person can experience serious brain damage. Add a minute or two more, and death can be a real possibility. But there are ways to buy extra time, most notably CPR. The American Heart Association estimates that somewhere between 100,000 and 200,000 lives could be saved each year through CPR. And now, a free smartphone app called PulsePoint is helping people do just that in Champaign County. The app was launched just a few days ago by Presence Regional EMS and MetCab, and it works by alerting its trained users whenever there's a nearby cardiac arrest victim in a public place. They aren't meant to replace the work of first responders, but it can help with those critical minutes until that help arrives. Bob Holloway and Les Meninga are paramedics from Champaign County who are acutely familiar with the importance of CPR and the emergency of time in these medical situations. And they're joining us now from our Urbana studios. Hi, Bob. Hi, Les. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. Thanks for having us.
Hello, Nyla. Thank you very much.
Bob, you've got more than 15 years of experience working as a paramedic, and you train future paramedics at Presence Regional. Why do you think this smartphone app could help save lives in Champaign County?
That's a great question. As you had said before, that about 1,000 people die a day from cardiac arrest, and brain death occurs within 4 to 6 minutes. And it takes about 4 to 10 minutes in order to get trained first responders, fire, and EMS onto the scene. And fewer than about a third of our cardiac arrest victims provide bystander CPR. And so if we can provide more bystander, hands-only CPR to our victims, we can improve our survival rates.
Les, how does the app work?
The application actually is integrated with the 911 system here with MetCAD in Champaign County. And when somebody places the 911 call, the input is put in by the telecommunicator, and the software notices that CPR may be needed at a location. And then who has downloaded the free app, PulsePoint, they will receive an alert, like a weather alert, to their phone. So if they're within a certain radius, typically about a quarter mile, they will receive that alert, and they can go provide bystander CPR to the patient that needs it.
And, Bob, how will this work? Can anyone download this and get these alerts, or do they have to somehow prove that they've had formal CPR training?
No, actually, anybody can download the app. It's free. There are no requirements for having to prove or be vetted that you know CPR. And then we can connect people through the app on how to provide hands-only compressions. There are a multitude of resources online. The American Heart Association has a plethora of one-minute videos on how to provide hands-only CPR. And that's actually one of the jobs that Les and I do within the EMS office is to teach CPR on a regular basis.
Les, as an EMS educator, I have to say, you know, I had CPR in high school. I think a lot of people do, right?
Yep.
Where you have the CPR class. It's been a long time since
it's actually a requirement. So we're excited about that.
So, I mean, I did that, but I think I would be really nervous about performing CPR on someone who needs help. I mean, how do you all, you know, you guys have, I always think you all are the ones who have on-the-ground experience, you're a paramedic. I wanted to first ask you how often you've seen people use CPR to help save either family or friends or even bystanders. Is that a common thing right now?
Unfortunately, it's not very common. And that's our goal, is to increase that, the number of times that there is bystander CPR. Many calls I've been on, there's been instructions given by the telecommunicator over the telephone when they've called 911, and there's a really good response with that. Our goal is to increase the numbers of bystanders being willing to perform that. And most of the time, it's they were not in the right place at the right time. And now if we can notify them, it will let them know that there's something close that they could help with.
Bob, how would you suggest, I would imagine you would prefer that people who do this have gone through formal training. What kind of things, what's involved in formal training for CPR for people who maybe haven't done it for a while or maybe for people who never had a chance to have training?
Formal training can happen through a couple different mediums. There are online classes through the American Heart Association and the American Red Cross. There are in-person classes within your community, whether they're libraries or through the park district or through EMS offices. And it can take anywhere from about 2 to 4 hours per class, and you really get good at practicing compressions as well as giving breaths.
And so just to remind us, if you could just walk us through last kind of the compressions, the basic sort of, I wonder if you could just give us a quick minute or two explanation of CPR for people who don't remember or people who have actually never seen it.
Sure. We're really promoting the hands only with the app for our layperson bystanders, people that have not had the formal class that takes 2 to 4 hours. But we want a fast rate. We want a rate that goes about 100 to 120 times a minute. We want to push deep enough, so about 2 inches. You know, if we can think about squeezing a person in half, basically, that's what we're looking for.
So like beneath the solar plexus, if I'm recalling
correct.
Correctly, right?
Yep, correctly. Right in the middle of the chest, we're going to expose that chest, and we need to go hard and fast, about 2 inches and 100 to 120 times a minute is what we're looking for.
And, I mean, are there dangers, Bob, to people doing this if they haven't had formal training? Could people make a situation worse?
Absolutely not. These victims don't have a pulse to begin with, so they don't have any blood circulating to their heart, their brain, their lungs. And anything is better than nothing at this point. If people are worried about getting in trouble or doing it incorrectly or any kind of liability, Illinois actually has a law to protect them against that called the Good Samaritan Act.
Right. And those are pretty common, I imagine. Most Good Samaritan laws exist throughout the U.S. So what's the single biggest mistake someone could make while administering CPR, Les?
Probably the biggest mistake is not realizing that the patient needs CPR. We want to know the signs. So if somebody is not awake, if they're unresponsive and they're not breathing normally, sometimes when the brain is as it's dying, not getting the oxygen it needs, it will have gasping respirations and the patient is not breathing normally. And some people wait until that breathing completely stops. And during the first couple minutes of that gasping, there has been no pulse. There's been no heartbeat. So recognition of needing to start CPR is probably the largest mistake.
Yeah, Bob, how can you tell if someone needs CPR?
So what we're first going to do is we're going to look for responsiveness. So is the person responding to you? You're going to tap and shout them. Can you wake them up? And we want to tap them hard enough that if they're taking a nap, right, that they would actually wake up. And then if they're not responding, we're going to look if they're breathing normally. So we're going to look to see if there's any kind of chest rise and fall. And if we don't think that there is, we're going to go ahead and start CPR. The consequences or chances of hurting them if they don't need it are actually very, very small.
Okay. So how does, if we can ask, that makes a lot of sense in terms of the CPR. If I want to just ask you particularly about the app, Bob, where else has Pulse Point already been used throughout Illinois? We mentioned it just launched in Champaign County this week, but it's been used in other parts of the state already, correct?
Correct. We're actually the third agency to implement Pulse Point within Illinois. AMT out of Peoria is an ambulance service, and they have multiple dispatch centers where they've implemented the app, so all over Peoria and western Illinois. And then Naperville Fire Department, which is about an hour outside of Chicago, has also implemented Pulse Point.
And why was it important for you to implement this? I mean, did you hear about it from those other folks across Peoria and Naperville?
It's actually been a big national movement. Presence Regional EMS is an American Heart Association training center. So educating people in CPR is one of our primary missions. And Pulse Point has been gaining notoriety over the last 5 years or so and has already seen an increase in survival rates with over 1 million app users across the U.S. and 2,500 different communities.
And do we have a sense, I know it's just started, but do you guys have a sense yet of how many people in Champaign County or how many people in Illinois have downloaded the app?
We don't have those numbers at the moment. We've been watching our responder map grow over the last couple of days through our big media blitz. And we've seen users in Champaign County triple so far.
Users, wow, triple. Okay. And so, Les, can you explain how user-friendly the app is? Like you said that it gives you an alert. And I think knowing CPR, we've kind of gone through sort of a little bit of the basics of CPR. But then I wonder, navigating it through a smartphone app, how that would work.
Yeah. You just go to the Apple iTunes Store or the Google Play Android Market. You just search Pulse Point, and it's available right there to download for free. When it finishes downloading, there's an end user agreement that the downloader will click on and accept. And it even has a little display on how to provide compression-only CPR. It even has a metronome, so if you're worried about going too slow or too fast, it'll pull up and it has a little ticking noise for a metronome. And then you just search the location that you're currently at. You can use the GPS location, or you can manually search. So for this area, you would put in Champaign County, and then it will actually show a display of current medical calls and fire calls. That actually comes through the CAD system at dispatch as well, and they can see that. But anytime there's the CPR needed, it will actually just give the alert. It has an audible tone, so you know it'll pull out the phone, look at it, and it'll give you the location. It's very simple.
We're talking about this free smartphone app called Pulse Point that's helping alert citizens to help in CPR situations. That's Les Menninga. He's a paramedic and EMS educator with Presence Regional EMS System. Bob Holloway is with us as well, where he's also a paramedic and used a training center coordinator. Bob, just to be clear, this only alerts users to emergencies that are taking place in public places, correct? It's not going to send people into someone's house.
That is correct. Only public places. We don't have any vetted users that are going to go into a private location. Citizen safety is paramount.
And both of you are with Presence Regional, as I said. Is this the first app you've ever rolled out for users, for citizens to help you guys?
Absolutely. In fact, this is a project that's been going on for about a year now to get implemented across a multitude of different agencies that were involved to make this happen. So it's been a really big really big deal for us.
It has been, and it sounds like it can be a great thing. And we've been talking about the fact that obviously this could make a difference. It could save someone's life. Bob, I would just want to end by asking both you and Les. And Bob, let's start with you. Obviously, this is only going to be successful if people download it and also then feel capable of using it to deliver aid during an emergency. What would you say to people who may be worried and think I'm not good in a crisis, or B, I'm not a trained paramedic, I don't have any medical training? What would you say to them? What kind of advice would you give them, Bob?
A couple things. One, something is better than nothing. And two, you're more likely to have or experience an event like this with someone that you know or someone that's close by. So while it's traumatic, we're really talking about the people that we live with within our communities.
Les, what about you?
I would still encourage people that aren't tech savvy or they're worried about that situation where somebody would need CPR. I would still encourage them to download the app. I think human nature, I think put in that position, they may act on it and actually become what we call the citizen hero, somebody that would provide the CPR and hopefully have successful results. That's our goal. And if they download it and they decide they don't like it, you can always uninstall it. It was free.
Right. And you don't necessarily have to use it either. I guess the point is you guys right. just want to do that. Bob, you said that you said, so you're seeing that people are downloading it, for example, across Champaign County. You can see where there are people who might be able to provide help. Is that what you guys can see on your map?
Absolutely.
So it looks like, but you haven't used it yet. Has it been used yet?
Correct. It has not given out any CPR-needed activations at this point. It is seeing a rolling scroll of active medical calls, so we know that it's installed correctly and that it's pushing out data correctly. We just haven't had a CPR alert.
That's Bob Holloway. He's a paramedic and training center coordinator with Presence Regional EMS System. I want to thank Les Menninga as well, also a paramedic and EMS med educator with Presence. Gentlemen, thanks for being with us to help us find out a little bit more about Pulse Point. I appreciate it.
Great. Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
As always, we'll tweet out information about that app. If you follow us on 21ST Show on Twitter, we'll have it at our website at 21stshow.org. That does it for us today. You can find past shows on the NPR One app, as we've been talking about apps. You can search for the 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa or Echo, we're easy to find. You have to have NPR One enabled, but you can tell them to ask NPR One to play the 21st. If you'd like directions for that, if you want links for how to contact us, you can always go to our website for anything we've talked about on today's show. That's at 21stshow.org. It's also a repository of all of our past shows. If you want to send us an email, follow us on Twitter. Our handle is 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more background and analysis. And we've also got, when we're not on air, the latest in Illinois news. You can always send us messages on Facebook, too. Search for the 21st to like us. We're produced by Robin Lynn, Alan Montecelio, and Bob Holly. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Moore. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. I'm Nyla Boodoo, broadcasting today from the Medill School of Graduate Journalism in downtown Chicago. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.